when someone has metabolic dysregulation and their appetite is out of control, they're blamed for eating when it's not them that's actually doing the eat. It's their brain driving their appetite. And when you correct that, then, you know, when you correct the dysregulation and the messaging and the signaling that their brain is doing, suddenly it all stops.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, a monthly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and all that's working in the world of metabolic health and obesity care. Our aspiration is to be the first place you are going to go to find out what's happening, the latest updates, and the latest research in GLP-1 science and clinical practice.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show. It's brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Stefan Trapp, and I'm dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the GLP-1 field. Get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. And for today's episode, I'm very happy to have with me here Dr. Catherine H. Tumor, who is the founder and CEO of Total Weight Care Institute. She is a family doctor. Did I get that right? Which is for us in the UK would be a GP equivalent, but of course Dr. Tuma is based in the US and she's been working with patients looking for weight loss for a long time. And let me start with just asking you to give a little bit of your background. How did you get into using GLP-1s? And yes, tell us a little bit about this, please.
Well, as you mentioned, yes, I'm Dr. Catherine Tumor, and I have been using GLP-1s now for 15 years. I trained, the reason there's a difference between GP here and a GP in the UK is because a GP in the United States does not have residency training, so post-med school training, whereas family medicine is its own specialty. I trained at what is considered a metabolic center of excellence. And so I've always focused very heavily on metabolic disease. So when I was in practice, I had a lot of diabetic patients. And I started, when GLP-1s came out, I started noticing, or as I started using them more, that my diabetic patients were becoming very well controlled, but they were also losing significant weight. And so I started doing a little more research and I realized, you know, we had always been taught that obesity caused diabetes rather than the other way around. And it was very clear that as people's metabolic status was being corrected, their weight was dropping. And so that was my first clue. I started using it more and more, what's considered off-label here in the United States, for that purpose. So instead of waiting until someone was actually diabetic by our criteria, I started treating them beforehand and had the same results. And so as people would come to me and ask for help with weight management, I started testing them for metabolic disease. And when I found it, I treated it and then they would have their weight loss. And then I myself was put on a GLP-1 for my heart. When I was 36, I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure from pregnancy. I was at that time a type, an insulin-dependent diabetic. And in trying to get my diabetes under control, my weight dropped. And then when GLP-1s came out and I was put on it for heart stabilization, it dropped even more. And so a total of about somewhere around 110 pounds, which is, I guess, around 50 kilos. And so so that really drove me even more into the weight management space. Really, it's really metabolic correction space, but, you know, people tend to care more about their weight than their health. So I tend to focus on that. But that's how I became an advocate in using GLP-1s. Over the years, I've started noticing, you know, my arthritic patients who are on GLP-1 stopped complaining about their joint pain. My, you know, migraine patients who had migraines stopped complaining about their migraines. And I started seeing all these different things happening And the only common denominator was a GLP-1.
That's really interesting. And it's also for someone like me, of course, who is a basic scientist, very fascinating to hear these stories. And I think we can learn so much from these patient experiences and what is seen there in addition. And of course, so you yourself have also seen the cardiovascular or cardiac benefits of the GLP-1, which came a lot later than, of course, the use for diabetes. So in that respect, having so much experience with this, with the patients, but also with taking it yourself. Of course, these days, when we're thinking about these drugs, we're thinking a lot about nausea as a side effect of these drugs. Is that something that your patients report often? Is it a real concern? How bad is this, you would say? And is it very individual? What's your experience?
It is very individual. Most of the time when I see people who have issues with nausea, they're not my patients usually, because I don't escalate or titrate up their dose just because I can. I wait until it's absolutely necessary. And I find that when you do it that way, when prescribing it based on the person, not based on what the criteria or the recommendations are, the nausea doesn't happen. I don't have a lot of side effects with my patients.
So you are saying you're not uptight waiting. You're not going for the higher doses Mm-mm. that are used. You're using the basically diabetes doses.
So my criteria for the dose is based on the person's control of their disease state, not automatic. And so I try to get by with the lowest dose possible, no matter what I'm treating, whether it's diabetes, whether it's weight management, whether it's, you know, inflammation. I always go with the lowest possible, and I only go up if necessary. So usually if it's weight management, I wait until someone has a plateau before I even go up. If they're still, you know, losing weight on the lowest dose, it doesn't make sense to put them up higher.
Yes, no.
If that's the goal. If someone's A1C, when you're checking for diabetes, if their A1C is controlled at the second dose, why go up any higher? You know, so I don't titrate up. And so generally you avoid side effects when, and then also there's other things that can help with side effects. You start having people keep a journal, and then you start to see patterns of when they have their side effect, their nausea. And usually it's because they didn't eat or because it was first thing in the morning. And so it's more related to, you know, reflux rather than the actual medication itself. And so there's ways to get around it and to counter it.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence. Starting now.
Going very little back to when I looked at the front page for your Total Weight Care Institute. So I read there that you are dedicated to provide a comprehensive and compassionate alternative to the dismissiveness and shame to change model too often experienced in wellness and health and weight health spaces. Can I just ask about this a little bit? So with your patients, how much does that affect the patients? How much do they feel better with you there?
I know that many of my patients appreciate the fact that I've been in their shoes. I myself, like I said, have lost a significant amount of weight. I know the social interaction differences from, you know, being the size I am now and the size I was before. In many parts of the world, thinness is considered a social currency. And so people's value is based on their size. And unfortunately, that has been the case with overweight and obesity. And so I make sure that my language is very clear. I don't blame the patient. Many times it's not things they understand, and it's not a lot that they can control. When someone has metabolic dysregulation and their appetite is out of control, they're blamed for eating. When it's not them that's actually doing the eat, it's their brain driving their appetite. And when you correct that, then You know, when you correct the dysregulation and the messaging and the signaling that their brain is doing, suddenly it all stops. And so I make sure that my patients understand this. You know, I also give them some agency, give them some empowerment and control over their process. But at the same time, they take control without taking the blame for what's going on.
Is of course extremely important for their well-being, for the success of the therapy as well. So, and that was actually from that, if I would go on to the next point, and this is about with these GLP-1 drugs, of course, they are very efficient in bringing your weight down. But then once you've achieved your set point there that you're after, do you take patients off the drugs as well? And what happens then?
The drugs are still treating a chronic metabolic disease. And so when you stop the control, the disease returns, the lack of control, you know, so I don't take them off. Now, there can be some reset, like you mentioned, set point. So there are some things that can change. And often what happens when a patient has reached their maintenance weight, or even, and I don't really like to use weight a lot because I tend to, because our body goes where it goes when it's healthy. And so I don't set goals. I don't set numbers goals, you know, unless it's something to do with blood work and some criteria that I could check there. But when it comes to weight, it's really just letting people get healthy and their energy levels kind of guide where they go. And so when they get to that point, again, try to get by with as little medication as possible. So first I start spreading out the dose to see how far they can go without it before their symptoms start to return. And then, you know, cut back a little bit and keep that frequency for a while and then start cutting down the dose depending on where they are and see how low we can go before the symptoms start to return. And then if we can keep, you know, their symptoms at bay with the lowest dose and the widest frequency, then that becomes their maintenance.
Yes, this makes an awful lot of sense. But so you haven't had any patients who could come off it completely then? Because, I mean, diabetes, I guess we could expect to resolve if it is driven by being overweight in the first place. Then, of course, you might reach a point where actually type 2 diabetes is disappearing then.
Well, this is the thing. I think it's a mistake that we think that obesity is causing the diabetes rather than the metabolic dysregulation causing the weight gain. Because if you think of someone, by the time someone's diabetic, they have probably been heading up to that for 10 years. And, you know, they start with, you know, their insulin resistance, then they become pre-diabetic, then they become diabetic. During that time, they're gaining weight. So by the time they're diabetic, they have obesity also, but that's not where they started.
Yes, but I mean,
and so often if we treat the dysregulation, we wait until someone's here at the tail end. If we treat them at the beginning, they never become obese, but their metabolic regulation is corrected. So it doesn't, you don't fix diabetes with weight loss. You fix diabetes by changing someone's metabolic status. And the way you change their metabolic status is usually through brain sensitivity to glucose and muscle.
So insulin resistance, of course, is one of the drivers. And of course, there is a link also between obesity and insulin resistance. So that the idea that obesity can drive the insulin resistance as well.
It's kind of hard. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
It's a chicken.
It's
egg.
Like one of, yeah, it's one of those situations you can't really say for everyone. It's not a direct correlation. There's a connection, definitely, but it's not necessarily a correlation. We do know that metabolic dysregulation causes weight gain. It changes what your body does with food, and it also changes your behavior around food. And so that combination does lend itself to overweight and obesity. Whereas you have many people who are thin and diabetic. So it's not, diabetes can happen even without obesity.
It can, but of course, when we're looking at statistics, there's a strong correlation between body mass index and the incidence of diabetes.
But as someone who is also type 2 diabetic, who has been obese, I wasn't always obese. So being young and athletic, so my metabolic dysregulation is genetic. So when my genetics hit a trigger, which was stress, my metabolic status changed, and therefore my weight started changing. And it wasn't until my A1C was probably climbing all that time along with my weight. And it wasn't my weight that caused my diabetes. It was my genetics meeting a environmental stimulus, so to speak.
I mean, you said in the beginning that you were an insulin dependent.
That was by the time I was obese at that point. When I was younger and not obese, you know, so my point is that my obesity didn't cause my diabetes. My diabetes caused my obesity.
Right. Yes.
And so it was genetic more than anything. And that's how it is for most people. You have, you know, there's a environmental trigger that meets their genetics, and then their body reacts. And how their body reacts is different based on their genetics. And so that's generally what we're seeing. And the environmental trigger here in the United States happens to also be our food supply. So we have a lot of preservatives in our food. We have a lot of things in our food that, you know, our body doesn't know what to do with. And so it stores it as fat because it can't figure out how else, you know, to manage it. And that's also why you don't see the same levels of obesity in other parts of the world, because their food is different.
Well, yes, very, very interesting. Thanks very much. Actually, time is flying. We're already at about the half time of our podcast. Mm-hmm. So just for our listeners, short notes, if you are enjoying this episode of the GLP-1 podcast show, which is presented by Wisenetics, please remember to like and subscribe and share it with your friends and family. You can also set notifications on from our channel so that you don't miss any of the upcoming episodes. And please feel free to leave us feedback, leave us your comments at any time, because your feedback is always very valuable to us. So thank you very much to all our listeners. Right. If we now carry on for the second part of our podcast. So from what you've just said, it also made me wonder about gastric bypass patients. And because, I mean, they also see then changes. They see their diabetes resolving very quickly and see changes in how their intrinsic GLP-1 is working. Do you work at all with gastric bypass patients as well?
Yes.
And when you see kind of side effects, things nausea, do you see some parallels between your GLP-1 patients and gastric bypass patients, or is it all completely different, or do you see any link between the two groups?
Usually so the only issue I have with gastric bypass is that because many people who overeat or who are, their appetites are driven, it's more neurologic. This is a neurometabolic issue. And so by making their stomach smaller, you're not fixing the problem. You're fixing the result. And so often what happens is, since the underlying problem is still there, which is brain insulin resistance, and so glucose not getting into, getting the messaging of glucose not helping, and so the body missignaling. So what happens then is that the stomach's smaller, but the cause is still there. And so over time, it reverses. So many of the patients I see who've had gastric bypass, it's because it was not successful long term. They had immediate results, but then over time, those results reversed because the cause was never. Because most people, and I can tell you, most people who are overweight or have overweight or obesity are not overeaters. It's their body's reaction to the food they're eating. So they have a carbohydrate metabolic issue, and so they have fat production from very few calories, but they don't eat that much. And so often I can say this even for myself, I eat more now at, you know, 100 pounds less than I did when I was 100 pounds heavier. And mainly because my body composition has changed. So now I have more muscle. My muscle to fat ratio is different. So my metabolic status is different. And so I can eat more and my body reacts differently to it. Granted, I'm also on a corrective medication. So, you know, GLP-1.
I mean, of course, overall, with this, I would say the roots of the laws of thermodynamics, they do apply to all of us. So we can't. So I think
to a certain degree, yeah, they do.
I would say there, yes, because you've got more muscle mass. That is why you're burning more calories. You're more active than you were when being very overweight. So I don't think that you can produce less fat or from more food or vice versa. In the end, that is simple chemistry or so.
Think of it like this, though. But I mean, like you said, you do brain research. So if the brain uses glucose and ketones for its structure, for its function, and it's not getting any messaging from glucose because of the insulin resistance that's in a person, that one signal is not, suddenly the brain is not getting the message that a person's eaten enough. They're not getting a message. Or it's getting the message that a person's starving simply because glucose is not getting into the cell. So what does it do then? It tells the rest of the body, as soon as this person eats, take it and store it because they're starving. So make fat based on the calories that they're eating. And make sure they keep eating because obviously they're not eating enough. When in fact they are, it's just the message isn't getting to the one place that controls everything else, and that is the brain. And so, you know, it makes sense that as soon as you increase insulin sensitivity, it all reverses. And that's what GLP-1s do. They just, all they do is increase insulin, well, they do other things, but the most effective that you see, the one thing that people comment about the most is that their appetite changes. And it's not because of gut motility. It's suddenly because the brain's now getting the signal it needs to tell the person you don't have to eat now.
When we spoke earlier, you said you think there's changes that still have to happen in order to get the full benefits of this class of incretin medications. So when you hinted at that, can you just elaborate a little bit what you meant with that?
Well, because of the work that they do, there's things that we can do to help. And one of them is building muscle. One of them is by just changing our metabolic status. So building muscle is one of those things. The other is by countering the things that drive us further into insulin resistance. And that would be controlling stress. So controlling our cortisol. The other is if you're a woman of a certain age, so menopause will also do the same when we lose the protection of estrogen and progesterone. So, and then just making sure that all of those things are done, sleep and the hormonal changes from sleep. And so just helping by having, you know, your activity support what it is that the body's trying to do to correct itself, and that GLP-1s are helping the body do to correct itself. And there are other things that you can do, watching, you know, managing your, you know, carbohydrates, maximizing protein so that you can build the muscle that you need, so your body doesn't go after the muscle that you're not eating, I mean, the protein you're not eating. So all those things can help with making the medication more effective.
Okay, that's very interesting. Thank you very much. So, we actually, it's a shame. We're almost running out of time and there's so many more things to talk about. So let's just pick maybe one more topic. And so that is, so where would you see the future of the use of these incretin mimetics?
The future, I see it being used. It's already being used. Like we said, in the United States, we have what something is called off-label. Our Food and Drug Administration determines what a medication is supposed to be used for. Many times physicians, myself included, use these medications off of that indication. One of those was weight management, which is why we ended up with a change in indication for these medications. But we've also, many, like my cardiologist, used it for heart, which until just recently was told that it was had cardiovascular benefits. But I've been on one for 14 years for a cardiovascular reason. There's, you know, addiction. It's been used by psychiatrists, many psychiatrists for addiction. And now we're starting to see that our patients who are on these medications stop smoking, stop drinking. Many of them, if they're on any type of pain medication, we have to be very careful because they can have withdrawals because they stop taking it. you know, those type of things. Mood stabilization as well. We're seeing a lot of it, that anti-inflammatory. So we'll see it definitely in the use of arthritis, other inflammatory diseases. We are already using it in micro doses for women who are in menopause who do not using any BMI criteria, just simply because their metabolic status changes. And we can see that by their fat production and where that fat is deposited. So all of these things, I mean, I think it's going to, we're going to see this, the use of it becoming more and more over the years. And the key is making sure that it's being used safely and used and monitored properly so that we don't get the complications, which we didn't have with diabetes, because diabetics were not abusing the medication. And unfortunately, there has been some abuse going on, going back to the psychosocial reasons for why people want to use it.
So what do you mean with abuse being going on? Because I would be thinking, well, they're actually, these drugs, they would reduce abuse, you would think, because they are actually, I guess they're reducing the reward that there is from drugs, for example. So where does the abuse lie with these drugs?
The abuse lies in the medication itself. People are abusing the actual GLP-1. So they're getting thinner. And so their drive is to be thin. So if you have, if someone's, you know, dopamine reaction, their abuse reaction is from not eating, as in anorexia nervosa, and you have a medication that stops you from eating, it feeds it and it becomes this vicious cycle. And so we're seeing more and more of that. We're seeing more of it. And then because of the access, people can get it very easily. It's not regulated very well in terms of, there's not any real gatekeeping happening.
But of course, it is a very expensive drug for most people.
It's getting less and less expensive, especially now with the compounded pharmacies making it. You know, from the pharmaceutical companies, yes, it does cost quite a bit, but even they're dropping their prices significantly.
So would you, for your patients, would you advise them against getting this from internet sources or so, because they don't really know what exactly they're getting?
I do. But at the same time, I myself as a physician, knowing that patients were going to do that, I just started vetting my own source. When there was a shortage, again, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States says that other places can make these medications. All I did was go to see who the FDA or the Food and Drug Administration said could make it. And so those facilities are still in operation. So if you get your medication from those places, then they're safer than if you just get them from anywhere. And so that's what I did. I just vetted a source so that when people said, I'm going to buy it on the internet, I'm like, stop here. Go to this place and get it.
Okay, right. It's a real shame, but we have to stop now, I think. So thank you so much, Dr. Toomer, for this interesting interview.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it. I hope our listeners enjoyed it as well. And yes, this concludes another episode of the GLP-1 podcast show, presented by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and stay in touch with us. Stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review. Your feedback is absolutely invaluable. So until next time.
And can I add one thing, just because I know that people, if anyone wants to contact me, they can also at drtoomer.com, because often I get questions after doing the podcast.
So yes, I hope everyone got that. So this is Stefan Trapp signing off from the GLP-1 podcast show now. Thank you very much for listening.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.